This week, the State Board of Education approved an updated school accountability framework. It's the next iteration of the Strive High Performance System, revised to sync with the federal Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA. ESSA replaced No Child Left Behind almost 18 months ago. Tammy Chun is the Assistant Superintendent to the Office of Strategy, Innovation, and Performance. We talked yesterday about the intersection of state-driven education and the requirements still mandated by the federal law.
Under ESSA, we've really tried to change the paradigm of our relationship with the federal government. So rather than just following what the feds said we needed to do, we really tried to say, what do we as a state want to accomplish and achieve for education? So in last year, we worked on a new strategic plan. And in December, the Board of Education adopted that plan unanimously. And it is our action plan for the next 3 years for public education. And so what we did was we really said this strategic plan represents our vision for what we want to achieve for our students, and we're going to use the ESSA requirements as well as the different resources that come from the federal government to try to achieve equity and excellence for our students. That said, the federal law is still there. It comes with a lot of funding but a lot of strings. The law is over 1,000 pages, and we have to write a plan to talk about how we're going to meet the federal requirements in order to receive those funds. But we tried our best to harness the federal resources to our purpose and our goals in the state.
And how well does that fit in with the governor's blueprint?
So the governor's blueprint really sets the long-term vision. It's our visionary and aspirational plan for what we're trying to achieve with public education. But the DOE-BOE strategic plan really tells us what steps we're going to be taking in the next few years towards that longer-term vision that's in the blueprint.
What steps are in the pipeline now that people will begin to see as some form of difference in the way they may have perceived it in the past?
In the past, one of the major criticisms of No Child Left Behind was that it really narrowly focused on reading and math because of the way that the test scores and the school accountability was constructed by federal law. And one of the things in the strategic plan is we really made it a point to say that students need a well-rounded education, that all subjects matter, not just reading and math. Reading and math are still important, but we also need other subjects to matter as well. Also that the whole child is important, not just the academics. And it takes students who are safe, healthy, and supported to feel that they're safe, healthy, and supported so they can be successful in their school endeavors. And I think those parts of the strategic plan are getting a lot of focus in our schools right now. I hear a lot of schools and teachers and principals talking about it as they plan for next school year.
How does the Strive High Performance come into play? How would you explain that?
Some of the principals have said one of the important things about the data that we're providing through Strive High is when they see chronic absenteeism, they really want their community engaged with them on that, because getting students to school is partly about what schools do, but it's also what the community does and families do. So part of No Child Left Behind was a new kind of school accountability, which was really test score based. It really did put a focus on academics and equity issues about the academic performance of different groups of students. As we move forward under ESSA, we really wanted to take advantage of flexibility and think about how to rethink the academics to better reflect what we wanted to achieve. So this week, the Board of Education unanimously passed a new accountability framework for our schools. It really focuses on providing information for the community as well as educators about the progress of our schools and our state on the strategic plan indicators for student success. And then it really looks more at providing information rather than trying to rate and rank schools.
So talk a little bit about those indicators that may be different from the ones that people might have heard under No Child Left Behind or still be carrying with them.
Sure. So the indicators that have been approved now for Strive High really reflect the decisions that the Board of Education made in December with the strategic plan. So we're looking at whether or not our students are empowered by learning. So are they achieving their aspirations for the future? So for example, what we're reporting on for our schools are whether or not students are graduating on time, whether or not they're enrolling in higher education, as examples, whether or not our students have well-rounded education. So we're reporting our students' achievement on language arts, mathematics, and science. We're reporting the test scores of those on those subjects for schools across the state, and then inviting our schools to provide information about how our students are doing in other aspects of education, whether it be arts or social studies or interdisciplinary projects where they're demonstrating across subject matter how students are performing academically. So those are some of the measures that are being included.
Those well-rounded ideas that you just talked about have not necessarily fared well when it comes to funding with so much attention to, for example, STEM education. How is that shifting to be able to bring people back into that conversation about whole education as opposed to very specialized and career-tracked education?
So one of the parts of strategic plan is really to say students need to be empowered by their learning to achieve their aspirations for the future, whether that's college or whether it's workforce right after high school. So we really want to make sure that students are having the opportunities to be engaged in their learning, and that does take well-rounded education and attending to the whole child. So in terms of the funding, we have really challenged our schools to look at how they're allocating the resources that they have to better consider what their students need, and then to go ahead and put the resources towards those particular needs. So for some schools, they've always had a well-rounded program. And for other schools, they really focus narrowly on reading and math, and this is freeing them up to feel like they can have a broader focus. In this year's legislative session, unfortunately, the school weighted student formula, school budgets weren't increased. So our schools really have to look at the resources they have and prioritize what's important for them, but they have that opportunity through their planning process.
Some schools may find that difficult to do. Other schools may find it, as you mentioned, easy because they've always had a well-rounded education. Is there a pressure, though, on a lot of the schools, given that there has been so much attention on STEM?
I think that people are excited about the opportunity to think about how to have arts in their school in a robust way. There's different ways that schools are doing it. Part of what is happening is schools are getting inspired by others who are leading the way in this area. For example, we have three schools that are part of the White House Arts Integration Initiative that are including arts practices or arts throughout their classroom. So you can be visiting a classroom that's working on science and they're using arts-related techniques to be able to learn about science, for example. And so we have a program called Bright Spots, or a strategy called Bright Spots, where schools are visiting one another to see what's really working and how do you make it work in the Hawaii context, and then taking those lessons back to their own school and thinking about how do we make this work for our school. So we're seeing some of that happen with the arts as well as our programs around transition centers. So how do we help create programs that welcome new students into our school so that they can feel aloha when they come and be connected to their school and have a good educational experience.
As the schools are now driving more how they will create their own curriculum and what will get what weighting and how much funding will go to what parts of it, how will that be transparent to communities so that they can actually be part of that process?
Our community members are so important, whether they're parents or businesses or people in the community who are interested in the school. So there's a couple of different ways that we have already for schools community to be involved in this. So one way is we put out reports every year. So the Strive High reports come out each fall about the prior year's school progress, and you can see how your school is doing. So on the indicators we talked about earlier, you can see what's the graduation rate at the school in my community, what's the college going rate, are students coming to school? What's the chronic absenteeism rate at this school? What do students think about the school climate? Additionally, we have school community councils, and the school community council's one of the responsibilities is that they review the academic plan every year. So that's really the school plan. How are we using our resources? What are we focusing on and prioritizing for instruction and student support at our school?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tammy Chun is the Assistant Superintendent to the Office of Strategy, Innovation, and Performance. She was appointed in June 2015. More about the School Accountability Framework approved by the Board of Education is on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a contemporary choral classic in a rare Hawaii performance. But first, your quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholave, uhawaiti.
A little later in the program, we'll be hearing from the new head of the Republican Party of Hawaii. So with that in mind, we're looking at the history of that political party for today's Backyard Quiz. The Republican Party of Hawaii was founded in 1901, over half a century before statehood. Two state governors have been members of the Republican Party, Hawaii's first governor, William Quinn, and more recently, Linda Lingle. Although it was officially founded in 1901, the Republican Party of Hawaii's roots actually date back to much earlier years in Hawaii's history. The party came into being when a prominent Native Hawaiian leader and his followers defected to a now-defunct local party, which then became the Republican Party of Hawaii. Today, we're looking for the name of that once political party. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know. And the first right answer gets the prize.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter-Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
The sound of massed voices is the sound of pure emotion, and some of the greatest composers have saved their most inspired efforts for the sound of a chorale. Dan Forrest is a rarity, a young composer who specializes in choral works, among them his Requiem for the Living, which has been performed by chorales around the world. It's the centerpiece of the Windward Choral Society's 9th Annual Spring Concert, and its artistic director, Susan McCurry Dupree, is with us in our studio. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Do you agree with that about the sound of voices?
Well said. I was just sitting here nodding my head.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And this young composer, he's not even 40 yet, he put together this extraordinary work called Requiem for the Living, just composed and published in 2014. And just as you said, all over the world, in its first year, it was performed over 200 times throughout the world.
The whole notion of a requiem for living, you know, contains a contradiction that immediately raises a question, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how does he explain that?
Sure. So a requiem, going back to the kind of the Catholic tradition, a requiem of a mass for those that have passed on.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes his own twist to it and says that really it's for those that are left behind.
Mm-hmm.
So if we've lost a loved one, this requiem for the living, this work really touches us, I think, in a very profound way. He's done a great job of tapping into what it's like for us that remain behind.
Mm-hmm.
I liken it to kind of the grieving process. The work is a 40-minute work, and it's in five movements, and kind of liken it to the so-called five stages of grief that people talk about. And he kind of walks us through that. We've mm-hmm. got a little anger. We've got a little bargaining. We've got, in the end, beautiful acceptance. And he sets it beautifully.
You know, the whole point of a requiem, as the word itself implies, is rest.
Rest, yes.
Right. Rest for the dead,
right.
And rest in the form of peace of mind for the living.
Correct.
Yeah?
And the text, Requiem Aeterna Dona Eis Nobis, I said that actually wrong, but Requiem, rest eternal grant to them, O Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about rest not only for those that have passed on, but peace for us, for those that remain behind. Like at the very end of the whole work, the last words from the chorus is Dona Nobis Pacem, grant us peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a beautiful work for our time, and set in a very deeply kind of surprising, you know, for a contemporary work, in a very accessible way.
Mm-hmm. Just the fragments that I heard earlier this morning integrate the sound of the chorale with the sound of an orchestra. The chorale becomes an extension, you know, a whole other group of instruments.
Yes,
yeah?
Yes. And this work, we've got about 100 voices that are going to be singing in this concert that we have coming up, and a 20-person orchestra. Members of the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra will be joining us. And I think that's going to be a balance that works really beautifully in the space we're going to be performing at Kauaiho Church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a special one.
Here's a fragment of the piece that just sort of shows that integration of the sound of voices and the sound of the orchestra. It's obviously a very dramatic moment.
Right.
What's being said?
Right,
here?
Right there. It's the second movement of the work, called Vanitas Vanitatum, and what the chorus is saying there: all is vanity,
mm-hmm.
everything is vanity, and a lot of real anger in that. And it's the movement before, which is the introit, the requiem, ends very softly and kind of mysteriously, and then it boom, goes right into that wonderful clip that you have there of the vanitas, all is vanity, and the driving rhythm of the strings and the timpani. You can really hear the timpani. He sets some really, it calls for oboe, flute, horn, strings, organ, and a wonderful timpani and percussion part, and harp. You could hear that harp in there.
How does that message about vanity fit into the overall message of finding rest?
Right, and I think that goes along with kind of the five, the different stages of grief, if you will, that that it's not all pretty. And I mm-hmm. think that it's a very angry, he starts off in the chorus in a very, it's a mezzo piano, a softer dynamic,
mm-hmm.
and it just builds and builds and builds from there until we wind up in this massive fortissimo where everyone is just blasting away. And I think it taps really into that kind of the anger stage of grief, or I can't believe this is happening. And I think he taps into that quite well. Then right after that movement, he goes into a beautiful setting of the Agnus Dei, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world, and a beautiful setting of that.
Mm-hmm. So the music, in a way, builds the way anger builds.
Correct. Right. Exactly. And kind of quietly, and what he does with the orchestra, the texture thickens,
mm-hmm.
and what the chorus does. Very dramatic changes in tempo, in meter, in dynamics. And I think that the grieving process, we kind of sometimes find ourselves not sure where to go with our emotions. And we're very excited to present a work that kind of think taps into that.
It really does sound like a contemporary take with a lot of,
yes.
a lot of historical roots at
Correct.
The same time.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And again, from a very young composer. Born 1978.
Well, nobody's perfect. Right?
He comes pretty. He's pretty darn good, and I think this work is gonna be around for a long,
yeah.
long time.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
I really appreciate the time.
Susan McCurry Dupree is the artistic director of the Windward Choral Society, whose 9th annual spring concert is a performance of Requiem for a Living by Dan Forrest. It's at Kauaiho Church, one time only, 4 p.m. Sunday, June 4th.
And it's free.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
It was supposed to last 50 years, but after only 18, a Maui complex for low-income tenants may revert to market rate, all because of a loophole. CivilBeat.org reporter Natanya Friedheim has the reality check. Hi there.
Hi. It's nice to be with you.
Good to talk to you, too. Now, how many people and how many units are we talking about who could be affected in just a couple of years, in fact, if things change?
So it's 142 units and about 300 tenants.
And did they have any sense that this was coming?
They did not. And in fact, the residents of Front Street Apartments had no official notice of this whole process. It was spread just through word of mouth among the tenants.
So there are some who are asking, how could that be legal?
Well, that's a good question. It is the qualified contract option that the developers utilized. It's an option because the development sits on private property, and because the landowner, 3900 Corporation, an affiliate of the Weinberg Foundation, raised the cost of the leasehold, so the developer could no longer afford to operate this complex as an affordable housing development. And so the project was no longer economically feasible. So that's why this qualified contract, which, you know, can say is a loophole, was, you know, the developer was able to utilize that.
So that was there all along, but nobody seemed to believe that it would be an option. Is that what we're hearing?
That's a good question. The original low-income housing tax credits were awarded to Front Street Affordable Housing Partners in 1999. And so to be able to speak with the people who originally awarded these credits, it's hard to know what they were thinking and whether or not they considered this qualified contract option when they originally gave out these credits.
For a lot of people, hearing that the Weinberg Foundation would be wrapped up in this seems to be counterintuitive. What did the Weinberg Foundation say when asked about raising the rent?
So they did not respond to my request for comments, so I wasn't able to speak with them.
And what do some of the Maui lawmakers who clearly are aware of this situation have to say?
Definitely. So Senator Rosalind Baker, who represents Lahaina, introduced Senate Bill 1266 this legislative session, and the bill was ultimately deferred, but it would have created options for the state to purchase the property in an effort to keep the units affordable. The original bill had a couple options for acquiring the property. One of them would have kept the units affordable through 2027, so not the full 50 years, and the other options didn't specify the length of times that the units would remain affordable.
You mentioned that this bill was deferred. Is it coming back next time around? And in the meantime, what are some of these tenants going to be doing?
So Senator Rosalind Baker expressed a lot of confidence that the bill would be kind of resurrected next year and that there's still time. Tenants are anxious. And Senator Baker said that in the meantime, it's hard to know what the general public and tenants can do in this effort. A lot of it is in the hands of elected officials. But she did say that tenants can keep the issue present in the minds of county lawmakers and state lawmakers. She said they can put the heat on to make sure that this issue is, you know, still alive.
Which in part is why you did the story. Thanks very much.
Indeed. Yeah, thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from CivilBeat.org, today featuring reporter Natanya Friedheim. It's a Friday, meaning that our news department is busy at work on stories that we will all listen to next week. Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, is here with a preview. So what's happening on the Big Island? We've got this story of juvenile justice.
Yeah, aloha, Bethan. You know, in so many cases when it comes to social problems, you look for programs that work, and then you build on those programs. And here's a program for young people who get in trouble with the law that is working and now may be growing on the Big Island. Mitch Roth, the county prosecutor for Hawaii County, started this approach. The idea is bringing actions and consequences closer together. So if you're a juvenile arrested, rather than going through a release to your parents and a family court case that comes months later, this compresses the time really between action and consequence, an immediate assessment. Sometimes those consequences come a lot faster. It's been set up in Operation Helicide for about 3 years now, and there have been positive numbers on reoffending. And so now he wants to take this over to the west side. Sherry Bracken's going to have a lot more on that.
Let's jump over to Maui. It's been a little more than 5 months since HCNS shut down, but we've got some news about sugar in the news.
Yeah, at least what's left of sugar, which in this case is some of the hardware. You know, the Pu'unene mill had a lot of machinery there, and it's still there. And Alexander and Baldwin owns the mill and the machinery. Not clear exactly what's going to happen, but what is clear is that the clock is ticking. So there is an auction that may be afoot later next month. We'll get details of that and sort of where that may go from Colleen Uechi of the Maui News next week.
And I understand we have a special movie screening happening next week.
Yeah, the 7th Art Stand, series of film screenings and discussions at Doris Duke at the Honolulu Museum, named for the 7 Muslim-majority countries that were part of that original Trump travel ban. It's being presented in more than 50 cities, Honolulu one of them, and Noe Tanigawa is going to have a lot more about that.
Well, thanks very much for the preview.
You bet.
HPR's news director, Bill Dorman. It's Friday, meaning that we also read your letters and emails. Following my interview with Habitat for Humanity West Hawaii Executive Director Patrick Herney, Rose Darling wrote on Facebook, "We really need this on Maui, too. Too many locals in Kanaka Maoli displaced by escalating real estate market prices and unscrupulous investors. Mahalo to Habitat for Humanity."
Andrea DaCosta tweeted us after this Monday's interview with Foundation for Government Accountability Fellow Jared Meyer. "The reasons are numerous, but Airbnb does so much harm to most local residents and only seems to benefit a few rich, connected, greedy owners."
And after last week's interview with state epidemiologist Sarah Park on the recent surge of mumps cases locally, Matthew Wolf in Honolulu tweeted, "More government support is needed to address public health issues such as rat lungworm disease and mumps outbreaks."
We thank you for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217.
Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Nohea Gallery, and Straub Medical Center.
The Republican Party of Hawaii elected a new party chair this month. Shirlene Ostrov is a retired Air Force colonel and Mililani resident who served as an interagency and legislative liaison. She also ran against Colleen Hanabusa for a congressional seat. Now she will try to do what her party has attempted to do for years, make the GOP relevant. Shirlene Ostrov joins us now. Thanks for the time.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You face a lot of the same issues as your predecessors, watching a shrinking sphere of legislative influence, infighting between different factions of Republicans. What will make your approach different from others who have led the party?
Well, I think that most
people have approached a problem from the same perspective. And what I'd like to do is make sure that we approach our very conservative cultural communities in understanding how their votes and their values are not necessarily aligned. And so being a Filipino myself of immigrant parents, whose vast majority of our community vote Democrat, but have very, very conservative values that range from social issues to financial issues, that we just haven't reached out to the communities in a meaningful way, and that's what we plan to do.
Relevance is a cornerstone issue, and it has two sides. Yeah. For former younger GOP member Beth Fukumoto, the lack of relevance was a big part of her reason for exiting the party. But for many, and often older, diehard Republicans, President Trump epitomizes that relevance. Do you see a generational divide in the party? And if so, how do you intend to bridge it?
Well, I think that most people look at the younger generation as a monolithic community, and they're not. I have 16-year-old twins who, so I'm around young adults who are, they'll be voting in the next election. And so I'm around them a lot, and they just, they have to be brought into the conversation in a meaningful way. And we can draw them in by making them understand the issues from their perspective and really their futures, and making them look at the issues not as what can I, what is convenient for me today, but where they will be in 20 years and how that will affect them.
It's often hard for younger people, particularly if you're talking about 16 and 18-year-olds,
yes,
to conceptualize next Tuesday, let alone,
it's
you know,
true,
10 years or 20
it's
years
true
from now. So how do you approach them in a, as you say, a meaningful way that gets them to understand the consequences of their actions now?
Well, you know, a lot of them will look at the recent actions and look at it in different ways. For instance, the Women's March. You can couch that in many different perspectives. And so you have young conservative people who go, hey, we are told to follow the rules in this way, and this community maybe isn't doing it another way. So it's really kind of each individual. It's engaging with their community so that they understand. So my daughters, for instance, are military kids, and we've lived all over the world and in many different communities, so we have that conversation often. Their friends that we've made since we've moved back here are local kids, and we have a different way of approaching those conversations, talking about rules and the future and all of those things in a way that might be a little bit more understandable for them.
So give me an example of how you are able to talk to them a little differently.
So let's say, hey, are you willing to... You know, if we were to talk about free college, that's a big thing, right, for kids. Free college, and, you know, you're going to pay it one way or the other. Or even looking at the rail. The rail's a good thing. You say, you're going to pay for this, and this progress is going to come out of this part of your pay or this part of your pay. Even if you're not going to use it, this is how it's going to work. And kind of bringing it down to those kinds of levels. And just making them understand that sometimes you're going to spend money even when you don't want to. And is that what you want? And there's other options perhaps to do that and approach it from a fiscal accountability standpoint. And kids understand, you know, you give a kid $10 and you say, well, $5 of that is mine. And so you got $5. Go, wait, I just worked, you know, I just worked for that $10. Yes, but $5 or $7 of that is mine. And so you've got $3. They understand. They understand it a little bit better. You got to kind of bring it down to their level. My kids, they've been hearing it their whole lives, but we talk about it with their friends all the time.
In a larger context, creating GOP relevance in a Democratic state such as ours is now with an all-Democratic Senate, that's going to continue to be an issue too.
Yes.
Now, Hawaii challenged the president's executive order. We're still waiting for the Ninth Circuit Court's ruling on the travel ban. Hasn't this further distanced the GOP from the values of diversity and immigration? You mentioned that you're the daughter of an immigrant,
yes,
family. Doesn't that really distance the GOP from some of what the state says it values and hence made the GOP less relevant to the state?
I think that Hawaii Republican Party has definitely lost relevance for many reasons. And so we've got to kind of bring back the whole basket of issues and immigration being one of them. I talk to the Filipino and the Samoan communities all the time in Kalihi, and they actually support the president's immigration initiatives. And you wouldn't think that. But if they're standing there with you and me, my dad, for instance, said, I stood in line, I waited my turn, and this is a fair way to go about it. And, you know, if you were to talk about it one-on-one with people, they say, you know, cutting in line is not necessarily something that they would favor. And so, but you've really got to engage each person and engage the communities one-on-one and then talk about the issues, how it's pertinent to them.
So what other issues do you think has caused the GOP to lose relevance?
You know, I think that we've been, it's been claimed that we lack diversity. And that is dangerous that we lack diversity, which is why it's important for us. We have a new leadership team, myself being a Filipino. We have a Hawaiian, Samoan, Japanese, and we have somebody like Pat Saiku, who's been around for many decades. And then we have a 26-year-old on the executive committee. So we are really trying to broaden our range and our views to make sure that we remain relevant to a lot of different communities.
Hawaii's deep blue status also places many other state issues at odds with the White House and Congress. What role do you see for Hawaii's Republicans given this political climate?
Well, it's going to be tough. We've got a steep hill to climb, and we are supportive of our president. Many of us. I can speak for myself and I can speak for my party, but it is hard to get past that conversation with people in Hawaii because of its deep blue state. But we're going to keep trying and making sure that we engage people. It's going to be one person at a time, one community at a time, and really talk about the issues and not operate in this 24-hour news cycle soundbite world, that we really can talk about the issues and how it would affect them and their families' bottom line.
I want to thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Shirlene Ostrov is the newly elected chair of the Republican Party of Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we got to thinking about the origins of the Republican Party of Hawaii. Originally founded in 1901, our local Republican Party traces its roots back to the 19th century when the missionaries first came here. In the mid-1800s, the wealthy descendants of early missionaries banded together to create the Missionary Party. The party continued to gain power until the reign of King David Kalākaua, who sought to limit Western influence in Hawaii. The adoption of Hawaii's first constitution in 1840 pushed the Missionary Party to reorganize. It was this party that would morph again into the Republican Party when Prince Jonah Kuhio Kalanianaʻole and his supporters joined it after breaking with the Home Rule Party. The name of that immediate precursor to the Republican Party of Hawaii was the Reform Party, and nobody got that today, but that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com.
When Lewis Carroll placed his Alice in Wonderland in a world where nothing made sense, he created a character and a situation that could be adapted to any period of history and may seem especially suited to our own. The West Hawaii Dance Theater's retelling of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland brings some 80 young dancers to the stage, incorporating elements of ballet, lyrical, contemporary tap, and hip-hop stylings in their journey down the rabbit hole. Virginia Holte is the artistic director of the West Hawaii Dance Theater. She's on the line with us now. Hi, Virginia.
Oh, aloha, Chris. How are you today?
All right. These have to be fairly frantic days for you in the final days of rehearsal, getting ready for this, huh?
Oh, yes, but you know what? We're very prepared. We started working on this last year, this performance. So we have everything in place, all the props, all the folks, all the rehearsals, and I think everyone is just ready to go out there and have a great time.
How many people in this group, all told?
We have about 80 dancers, and we have some guests. We have special guest Heidi Hart, who is going to be our Red Queen, or Queen of Hearts. She's a famous local hula dancer here. Mm-hmm. And we have a couple of gentlemen that are coming over from the Maui Performing Arts Academy, and they're going to be doing several roles, dual roles. Mm-hmm. So it's quite exciting for our children here to have, you know, guest artists with this production.
It's kind of an appealing subject for a ballet, isn't it? Because it's sort of an anything-goes subject matter.
Yes, it is, and ours is very unusual. We had one of our longtime teachers, Megan Joy Chapman. She had this idea to create a kind of a little bit different version of the Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. It starts kind of at the beginning of the 19th century, and at the end, after she comes out of the rabbit hole, she's in modern day time. So it's a journey not only through different things, and, you know, as you were saying about our times are very different, but it does travel through time as well. So we've done quite an interesting job with it.
What do you think it is about this story that does make it travel, you know, translate to different time periods so well?
Well, because I think, like I said, anything goes. I mean, you can go to a tea party in London in the 1800s and the 1900s, and they even have them now. But maybe the costumes are a little bit different, the outfits are different, and the talk might be a little bit different, too, at those type of parties.
The whole atmosphere of absurdity, has found a lot of resonance with audiences over the years.
Yes, yes, and it's very whimsical. We have some exciting, very colorful, whimsical costumes. Gary Morphis, who does our technical directing, he's come up with some amazing theatrical things to go along with the performance. So I think it's really going to draw the audience in a very, very fine way. It's going to really put them right in there with the characters.
What kind of theatrical things, Virginia?
Well, we have some different slides that we're going to be projecting on the back. We also have some videos that we're going to be using. Parts of it, the students are dancing in the audience. Mm-hmm. Like we have a section with the flowers. The flowers, they're coming through the audience before they go to Alice, who's in the little door. So the door is going to fly in. We have some different things that are going to be happening there.
It sounds like a lot of different ways to sort of make it inclusive of the audiences.
Yes.
Particularly with having dancers out there in the audience. Yeah?
Yes, we do. And what's really kind of fun is we have a narrator. Megan Chapman came up with this idea of having a new character, and her name is Zoo Lily Fancy Pants, and she narrates the whole story. And she is just a comical character and really draws even the youngest of the 3-4-year-olds. When, like last week when we were rehearsing, they were just enamored with this Zoo Lily Fancy Pants character. So it was really, it's really fun, whimsical, and, you know, that type of thing.
You have an age group from, what you say, 3 or 4 to...
3. Mm-hmm. 3 or 4 up to our adults. We even have the adults in there all the way up to, I'm not going to say the name, I won't say how old they are. But
probably,
they're right up there in the good golden years ages.
So with such a varied cast, you have to sort of create a kind of a unity to mm-hmm. the performance, don't you?
Yes, yes.
And that involves getting everyone on board with the whole notion, the whimsical nature of the story itself.
Yes, Megan chose all the music, and then she divvied it up amongst all the instructors. So we each had our little tasks. Like Juanita Finkenberg, she put together this beautiful contemporary piece called The River, and it's a place where Alice gets to rest after she's kind of gone down the rabbit hole and went here and there, and then she gets to rest a little bit before she goes into the tea party where, you know, they're going to cut her head off, maybe not. Maybe this queen, Red King, is going to do something else. So, it was fun. It was a fun integrative for all of our instructors to put together.
Do you find that the kids already knew the story of Alice in Wonderland the way earlier generations did?
No. We actually had to tell them what the story was about. And we did that. We have coloring pages and things like that for the younger kids. The older children, we told them to look it up online so they can see the history of this book. You know, because it is very mathematical, too. You know, Lewis Carroll was, talked a lot about mathematics in here. And the music that we're using is very mathematical. It's different kind of music. We're using Jody Talbot music and from Carl Davis. And the counting of the music is different. Like, sometimes it's in 2, 4, 3, 6, 8, 12. So they had to really pay attention to that part of it, too. So even that is integrated into our program.
That can be awfully tricky for a large ensemble, yeah?
Yes, but you know what? They're doing it.
Great.
They really grew a lot as dancers. In fact, our performance groups, our junior performance group and our senior performance group, these kids are teens. You know, they're maybe 12 through 17, and they came up to the challenge. They love it.
I find it a little sad that people aren't familiar with the original Lewis Carroll text because, you know, the whole notion of Alice in Wonderland going down the rabbit hole, those have become part of our culture, but not so much in the original form you discovered, huh?
Right. No, not so much.
Well, this will be you're bringing the story to people then who might not have heard it before. That poses an additional challenge, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. Well, I think with the narration, that really helps. In fact, we usually narrate most of our ballets. We find that the audience really enjoys that. Because, you know, if they're just seeing people dancing up there, like, what are they doing? But if you have a little narration before it, afterwards, and you have the synopsis in the playbill, it seems to really bring it more to life to them.
And this is a ballet that incorporates other styles of dance, quite a few other styles of dance.
Yes. The Tweedledee and Tweedledum, they're hip-hoppers.
Oh, somehow that seems appropriate, doesn't it?
Yes. And the Mad Hatter is a tapper.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
That also fits.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, it's the kind of subject matter I would think, Virginia, that you could have an awful lot of fun with.
Oh, it's so much fun. And the very exciting part is we use one of our graduating seniors as the lead, and this girl is Katie Hendrickson, and she's been with us, dancing with us for 5 or 6 years. And since she's going off to college, it's very apropos that she's going to be having many different experiences in college. And we thought, well, you know, this is perfect. She's a senior. This is her last time to dance with us, and she's going to go down the rabbit hole here and maybe other places too.
Well, Virginia, thanks very much for talking with us. It sounds like a great show. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland is performed at the Kahilu Theater, one show only, Saturday, May 27th at 4 p.m. Virginia Holte is the artistic director of the West Hawaii Dance Theater.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
There's always a lot going on around the state, and that's why Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, Derek, we've got a lot of emphasis on fine art, don't we?
Yes, a lot of art. We'll start on Maui with the Lahaina Arts Society Fine Art Fair. They'll be exhibiting under the banyan tree next to the historic old Lahaina Courthouse. So check out paintings, ceramics, wood carvings, baskets, and more. The Fine Art Fair is under the banyan tree in Lahaina, and it's Saturday through Monday this weekend from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
That banyan tree is the scene of a lot of events, if it could talk, right?
It's seen a lot of things over the years.
This is the final weekend to see an exhibit on Hawaii Island as well.
Right. The Waimea Bonyukai is the oldest bonsai club on Hawaii Island. It's over 60 years old, and the bonsai exhibit showcases over 50 trees to delight enthusiasts and the curious. So talk story with members and view the bonsai. They appreciate the attention at the free event, the trees and the people do. It's tomorrow and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the Waimea Community Center, and it's free.
And if you haven't seen something like this, it's really something to see.
Yes, it is.
And you can see a visual artist paint to live music right here in HPR's Atherton studio this weekend on Sunday.
I think it's the first time it's happening. It's in collaboration with the Shangri-La Museum. HPR presents a performance and discussion with Syrian visual artist Kevork Murad. Murad will paint live in collaboration with music mixed live by our own DJ Mr. Nick in the Atherton studio. And this is happening Sunday at 4 p.m. in the Atherton. And go to our website for tickets to see this, a live drawing and animation mixed with DJ Mr. Nick's music. So that should be fascinating.
It should be unlike anything you've seen before,
yeah.
It sounds like.
Hope they have some, you know, canvas on the floor.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
Watch out with that
drippings
paint, right?
There. Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And that's going to do it for the conversation for this week. Join us on Memorial Day. Daniel Martinez, Pearl Harbor historian, and Captain Philip Cooper, a former officer with the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, will join us.
And we'll hear from the director of the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific.
We like to hear from you. You can always call the talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any part of The Conversation or any other show, you can find them on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Koslovich.
Lillian Song produces the program, and Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you on Monday when we pick up The Conversation.